This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks, the podcast that puts the cool into, well, not cool at all. I'm Michelle Owen from Sky Sports and my fellow geeks this week are...
Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV Sport.
Alex Crook, TalkSport commentator and reporter and national newspaper journalist. And with us this week...
I'm John Murray.
Coming up this week, John will be telling us how he went from being a farm boy to one of the country's top radio commentators.
We will be regaling you with tales of what Jurgen Klopp and Jose Mourinho got up to in the tunnel this week.
And I'll be giving you the alarming stat that suggests the Premier League's big clubs breaking away and forming a new European Super League might not be that bad idea after all.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
It was always going to be an emotionally charged weekend given the events at Leicester, and with two of the Premier League superpowers going head-to-head in a breathtaking game at the Emirates. So let's look at the main talking points in numbers.
Table-topping Manchester City thrashed Surrey Southampton 6-1. Pep Guardiola's side have now scored five or more goals in a single game a dozen times since the Spaniards' arrival. That's twice as many as any other club.
Home is definitely where the heart is for Alexander Lacazette. His equaliser in Arsenal's 1-1 draw with Liverpool was his 17th goal at the Emirates, with only six coming on the road.
And Manchester United probably won't win a trophy this season, but they can at least lay claim to being the comeback kings of the Premier League. After their last gasp 2-1 success at Bournemouth, the Red Devils have now taken 7 points from losing positions.
Now, there's something we need to cling on to. Go on, grab those straws.
Sam, you were at Arsenal on Saturday. What a match that was. Crook, you watched United steal that late win. You both got some interesting tales from the tunnel to tell us. So, Sam, start us off with what happened at your game.
Well, I thought it was fascinating, actually, because Manchester City have changed the way you look at these games. Liverpool played really well, I thought. Big chances in the game, probably the better chances in the game. And they could have won the game, but they didn't. And when you factor in that Liverpool have got to make up 25 points on Manchester City from last season to catch them, these games, the big ones away from home, are the important ones. So, deep in the bowels of the Emirates Stadium, in a soundproof box right at the back, I asked Jurgen Klopp, if it was games like this, matches like this, that underline how difficult it's going to be for his team to fulfil the task of catching Manchester City, let me underscore that the table is telling you a lie. I've said this before on this podcast, and I know I keep banging on about it, and you all think I'm boring, but City have played three of their five big away games already. They've played Tottenham, they've played Arsenal, they've played Liverpool, and they've taken 7 points from those games. Now, Jurgen Klopp's response to me when I asked him about this was, we don't think about City, actually. We don't think like you do. We just want to get as many points as possible. I've got 27 points from 11 games. And if I go into that dressing room and say, hey, but what about City? They've got this many, blah, 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 blah. That would be really silly of me. And I get it. He's right. To his players, he's got to manage their expectations. He's got to look after them over a long season. It is a long season and we are only at the beginning of it, really. But in a Premier League where the margins are tighter than ever because the top six are pulling away, the black box thinking, marginal gains, etc., etc., analytic data, all of that will say that there, right there, on Saturday night, is the major indicator of what is going to happen over the next 8 months. I'm not saying that Liverpool won't win the title because they didn't beat Arsenal away from home, but it is a lot less likely today than it was on Friday because Manchester City would have won that game.
It's interesting because I was watching that game in a pub on Saturday night, and 1-1 I think was a much better result for Arsenal than for Liverpool. It was a game that under Arsene Wenger they would almost certainly have lost, but I did say, as the guy I was watching it with, I still think by the end of the season, Manchester City win the league by at least 10 points. I don't think Liverpool or any of those other sides that have made fantastic starts, you know, Chelsea's still unbeaten, Tottenham are going well, Arsenal have overachieved probably, they're not going to be that close come the end of the season. Manchester City are still going to canter to it, in my opinion.
I think Jurgen Klopp almost knows this because he's a clever man and he's done a fantastic job with this Liverpool team to get them to where they are and to how they're performing. They're a much more pragmatic, in control team now than they were. But I could sense even from him, He's saying, I don't think about Manchester City, because he knows that they're on a different plane to everyone else.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you both. You know, if you look, I was listening to that game at the weekend. Unfortunately, I was in the car, so I couldn't watch it. But sort of listening to the opportunities and things that went begging. And, you know, with respect, I think James Milner is a brilliant player, but they've got to rely on James Milner to pop up with that goal in a massive game. If you look at Manchester City and the way they perform in big games, there's a big difference, isn't there? And I totally agree. I think they would have gone to Arsenal and killed them off.
They've changed the narrative, though, haven't they, City? Because, you know, you used to go away to one of the big six and think a point is a good result, but now they win those games. So you've got to win them if you want to challenge them. And that's the problem.
Yeah, and that's why I think the points gap come the end of the season is still going to be pretty vast. And I think if you said to Jurgen Klopp, in all honesty now, you can have runners-up spot, I think he'd take it.
What about Manchester United? Are they going to be anywhere near the top two or three positions?
Well, why are you asking, Crook?
What they've done in the last three or four matches is they've proven they are playing for the manager. The way they came back against Newcastle, if they wanted Jose Mourinho fired, they could have just not turned up in the second half in that game as they did in the first, and he would have been gone. The way they battled from behind to lead at Chelsea. And again, we saw it to a certain extent on Saturday, because for half an hour, there was only one team in that game. Jose made a couple of changes at the start of the second half. Herrera coming on, freed up Pogba to play further forward, Rashford up top, and that took the game away from Bournemouth. But it's interesting just looking at the contrast of emotions in the tunnel after such a dramatic finish, because Jose Mourinho, not renowned for his smiley features this season, he was in good form. He was with me for 4 or 5 minutes in a radio interview. There was none of these two questions because obviously they won. So he was happy to talk at length. But he was quite honest. He said they should have been 6-2 down at halftime. I'm not sure where he got the two from, by the way. But there was a really nice moment between him and Nathan Ake, of course, the Bournemouth defender who played under Jose at Chelsea. And he hugged him. They were standing literally 30 centimetres in front of me. He hugged Ake, who was still fully kitted up at this stage. And he tried to make a joke and console Ake, because he could see how devastated he was. He blamed himself, actually, for the late winner. He said he should have cleared the header. And he was almost in tears, Nathan Ake, in the tunnel. That's how much it affected him. And Jose just said to him, are you quick or was Marcus Rashford slow? Because he was talking about an incident towards the end of the game where they had a race for pace. Looked like Rashford was going to go one-on-one with Asmir Begovic, and Nathan Ake just got back there and made a tackle. So we saw a different side to Mourinho, but also we saw just how much defeat means to Premier League players, despite the riches that they get. Listen, it's not going to affect his bank balance that they've lost 2-1 in the last minute to Manchester United. But as I say, he didn't really see the funny side of Mourinho's retort. And literally, his head was down the whole time. He was almost wiping tears from his eyes. So I thought that was really interesting.
And the thing with Bournemouth, it's funny to say it, but they're neck and neck in the table, aren't they? Bournemouth and Manchester United, which is not something you would have expected to say perhaps at the start of the season. But for Bournemouth, that was a massive game. And perhaps before that game, they were thinking, OK, if we can overcome this, then maybe, you know, we're on for a top 10 finish, but maybe perhaps even higher, flirting with those Europa League places. Because now I think they're level on points, aren't they? They're sixth and seventh respectively. Bournemouth still above Manchester United at this stage, but I don't think it will stay that way for long, unfortunately.
Keep rubbing that in. Michelle, tell us about what you learned from your trip to the tunnel this weekend.
I'm going to go outside the tunnel, actually. I'm going to break out. I met Frank Lampard for the first time. He was a lovely man. I was doing Derby against Birmingham. I know Gary Monk really well. And for them, it was the end of their unbeaten run. 11 games, they went unbeaten Birmingham City. They were doing absolutely fantastically. But Derby just too good for them in the end this weekend, despite them taking that early lead. But what I found very, very strange at Derby, and I don't know if this happens every week, because I've been to Derby a few times, and I'm sure I have never seen this. But at the start of the game, two men, I think in uniform, walked out a ram on a lead. So obviously Derby are the Rams, aren't they? But they're walking out with this sheep between them. And I'm like, well, is the sheep okay? What's going on here? And it did a lap of the pitch and then it disappeared.
It honestly,
one of the most bizarre things, most bizarre things I've seen at a football match. And that's what sticks in the mind. Yes, Derby were very good and Frank Lampard spoke well. I mean, they are now just so close to the automatic places in the Championship. They could potentially be going into the international break next week in those places. But of course, like most managers, he was very, very coy and he played it all down. But he's got to be thinking now that they could be going up.
I spent the evening with a clutch of managers on Sunday night, and I must just mention this dinner that I was at with Pep Guardiola. There was Paul Warne from Rotherham, John Coleman from Accrington Stanley was there, John Askew was at Macclesfield, now at Shrewsbury was there, Tony Mowbray of Blackburn was there, and Mogger actually gave a very long, very winding speech in front of Pep and everybody else at the dinner, and that was the highlight for me. Because there was a particular moment which stood out, which I thought was, it just had me in stitches, where Tony Mowbray's standing up in front of everyone and he said, oh, I can't believe I'm here, really. And, you know, he's got a bit, quite a strong northeastern accent. I can't believe I'm here and I'm sitting next to Pep, and, you know, on the top table. And he was gushing away, talking about how I love his football, I marvelled at his achievements, I worshipped him so much that back in 2006, I took a trip to Paris to watch his wonderful team play Arsenal in the Champions League final. Pep smiled, slightly embarrassed, because mainly, I think, it was actually Frank Rijkaard's team that Tony Mowbray went to see in 2006, because Pep didn't become the manager till 2008. And like, Pep was in Mexico at the time, and everyone was sitting there going, all right, Tony, okay, crack on.
It was good stuff. The tumbleweed trickled across the stage.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Pep was great, by the way. I thought it was good company. It was good fun, actually. And it's really good that he embraced that tradition of getting together with the Northern football writers. I think the idea of fraternity is very important amongst the football community, especially at the moment. You're listening to All Football Commentators Are Geeks, the podcast that you can download via Google Podcasts, Spotify, Audio Boom, iTunes, anywhere you get your podcasts, we'll be there. And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter as well. It's at AFC Geeks on both platforms.
Lift off and the clock has started.
As all true geeks know, football commentary is all about stats, but can our team pick out fact from fiction? Well, let's find out. Crook, start us off. What have you got?
Yeah, well, as we've already mentioned, I was at Bournemouth on Saturday. It was the last home game for the Cherries before the Remembrance weekend, so there was a ceremony held on the pitch, as I believe a lot of clubs did, to mark the First World War, which, of course, ended at 11 a.m. on the 11th day of the 11th month. Would you believe Bournemouth scored their 11th home league goal of the season in the 11th minute of the 11th game, only for Manchester United to equalise through their number 11, Anthony Martial, and eventually go on and win courtesy of their 11th away league goal. Spooky.
That is spooky if it's true. But I'm going to say it's spin, because I don't think they have scored 11 away goals this season. There you go.
Michelle?
And I think it's spin. I think Bournemouth have scored more than 11 goals. In fact, I'm sure they've scored more than 11 goals, so it's spin.
It's actually a stat.
Ooh,
how
no way.
Incredible is that?
That is an absolutely belting stat. That is the best stat I've heard all season.
Yeah. You've won with that one, Crook. You've won the whole thing. Let's just go home.
We're never doing this
Scrap
again.
The game.
That's great. That is great. I feel a little bit inferior now when I throw out a James Milner stat. He scored for Liverpool at the weekend. It was his 50th Premier League goal. It was also the 49th Premier League game in which he has scored, and he has never lost a game when he has scored in the Premier League, which is four short of the record held by Carlos Tevez. Is that stat or spin?
I think it's a stat that Milner has never been on the losing side in a game in which he scored. I'm sure I remember noting this down for commentaries I've done in the past. But I'd be surprised if Carlos Tevez has never been on the losing side in a game in which he scored, bearing in mind that he started his career at West Ham. So on that basis,
yeah,
I'm going to go for spin.
Yeah. Mm. And with Crook, I think Milner's never lost a Premier League match he scored in. I've heard that one loads. But I think the Tevez one is spin as well, so I'm going to say spin.
You're both correct. Actually, by scoring that goal at the weekend, he set a Premier League record, James Milner. So he is the man who has never lost a game when he scored a goal, and he's a record holder as well, so well done to him. Michelle, what you got?
Okay, so Wolves lost 3-2 to Tottenham on Saturday. Very entertaining game. Ruben Neves, their midfielder, scored a penalty. And that was his first league goal he scored from inside the penalty area in English football. Is that stat or spin?
Stat.
Hmm. Raul Jimenez scored a penalty as well, didn't he? Neves hasn't scored inside the box. But now I'm going to go stat. If it was Neves who took that penalty, then it's a stat.
Neves did score a penalty, so it is a stat because he'd scored all his other 7 goals in English football from outside of the box, including that wonder volley. Remember that last year?
Against Derby, yeah.
So, yeah, that was his first inside the area.
Well, congratulations
to
him.
So that means we were all 100% correct this weekend.
Well, the fact is that it doesn't matter, does it? You know that you came up with the best stat, and that is the one that we will all be talking about when we leave here later on and trying to pass it off as our own. We know that.
Okay, so if you like the podcast, make sure you rate and review it on iTunes and subscribe via your podcast supplier. Coming up next, Crook will be joined by Radio 5 Live broadcaster and all-round top guy, John Murray.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Our guest geek this week has one of the most recognisable voices in the commentary business. A northeastern lilt he lends to golf as well as football. It's the smooth sound of John Murray.
I'm sat in the stand at Bournemouth with BBC Five Live's football correspondent John Murray. It's a glorious day here on the south coast. John, thanks very much for joining us. First of all, can you tell us how you became a broadcaster in the first place?
Well, my family are all Northumberland hill farmers, and they still are. And I was the fourth of 4 boys, and therefore there wasn't much space for a fourth son on the hill farm. So I was sort of ushered into other areas, really, and was encouraged, certainly particularly by my mother, to go and do something else. And I think she wanted me to be an auctioneer, strangely enough, so to keep that agricultural link, which when I think back is a bit of a strange one, because obviously that is very much, it's a bit like broadcasting without broadcasting, being an agricultural auctioneer. However, that didn't develop. And from quite a young age, really, I mean, the family of very much sports mad, sports orientated. We played lots of sport together, and at quite an early age, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be good enough to be a professional sportsman of any type. So the next best thing was to go into sports journalism, I thought. So I went through quite a conventional route, really. Went to university, then did a post-grad course in radio journalism. Started off doing both news and sport, and then over the years began to do less news, more sport, to the point where I was doing just sport when I moved from commercial radio into BBC local radio. That was on Teesside. So first of all, started working at TFM in the commercial sector. I was there best part of 5 years, and then switched across to BBC Radio Cleveland, as it was at the time, BBC Tees now. So that's when I started my BBC line of work. So I was the sports producer there, and then from there, after a very, I mean, the hardest year of my professional life working at BBC Radio Cleveland, I then moved to London to join the radio sports department there.
And clearly you have a reasonably broad regional accent.
Yeah.
Do you think that's helped you along
massively
the way?
Yeah, I do. I think that I was in a very fortunate position, and this, we're talking mid-90s. So when I moved to London, initially as a producer, strangely enough, so I was producing the sports desks largely and working on the local radio desk, which provides material for all of the BBC local radio stations. But we also got the opportunity there to do quite a bit of broadcasting, so people heard my voice, and I was in the fortunate position because at that time, and I think probably since then, regional accents have been popular, but it was at that time that you were beginning to see more and more regional accents. And strangely, before me, George Bailey had been the sort of northeast voice on BBC National Radio, and George was sort of coming to the end of his time there. He's still doing the golf, but he was doing much less football, if any. And so I think I happened to be a northeast voice at a time when that was something that we didn't have, and so I felt that gave me an enormous lift. So I always say to young commentators who've got regional accents, I say to them, look, keep it, don't lose it, because it could really be your passport to greater things.
You mentioned golf there. Obviously, you've covered many major golf events and also the Olympic Games. How important do you think it's been in your development and your career to have that versatility, and how much do you enjoy trying your hand at sports other than football?
Yeah, well, football's my bread and butter. and that's what I spend probably 90% of my working time doing and covering. But and I mean, everyone's different, aren't they? And I have colleagues who just do football, and you know, that they are thoroughly fulfilled doing that. I find that I need a bit of variety, and I like a bit of variety. And I find, even though, you know, football is my primary role, if I go away and cover the golf, or I go away and cover other events, the Olympics, Olympic sports, I find that actually revitalises me. And just to have that switch off and then switch back on, because you know what it's like with football, it never ends, does it? And even when you're off, even during the summer, it's very, I mean, you know, people who don't work in the industry will find it strange to hear us say that you do want to get away from it. But when it's your job and it's what you do, I think it is important to try and get away from it and try and take a break, because it is so all-consuming. And you feel, because it's your job, that you have to be across and aware of every major development and many of the minor developments that are taking place in the football world. So I find just that little break away, doing some other sport and thinking differently, and also every sport you do is a different approach and requires different thinking and different qualities. So I think that actually helps you. When I come back to football, you know, very often what I've used to cover those other events, I think, oh yeah, that, you know, there might be things that I can use here to with my football broadcasting.
You are football correspondent of Five Live. You're only the fourth person to hold that title. You replaced Mike Ingham. They were big shoes to fill. How daunting a prospect was that?
Well, what I like about working for the BBC is that historical thing. Well, amongst things I like from working for the BBC is the historical thing. You know, the BBC broadcast the first commentary in this country in 1927. That was BBC Radio. I work for BBC Radio. It's still, you know, the line is there. And what I like about doing this job is that there is that line back. So I worked with Mike Ingham, and Mike worked with Brian Butler, and Brian Butler worked with Brian Moore. So there is that thread that runs through it all, and that really appeals to me as well in terms of the history of football commentary, that I'm sure a little bit of Brian Moore will have rubbed off on Brian Butler, likewise to Mike Ingham, and I would like to think that a bit of Mike rubbed off on me.
We spoke to Darren Fletcher a couple of weeks ago, and he was quite honest and said that the only reason he got the job at BT Sport is because you turned it down. Is that true?
Yes, it is. It is. And that was, I think that was about 2012 time. And, you know, I've done the vast majority of my work as a radio commentator. And when Grant Best from BT, you know, called me out of the blue, it was an incredibly tempting offer. And the job that Darren does now was very much how Grant described it to me. You know, so often I think in those sort of circumstances you would think, crikey, this sounds too good to be true. But it was what he said. You know, it was a brilliant offer, and it was a very difficult decision. But in the end, I'll tell you what it was. It was probably the right offer at the wrong time. You know, and I would have loved the opportunity to do live TV football matches, which is something I've never done. I've done lots of Match of the Day games, but I've never done live TV football, and I think that would be a great challenge. But I say it was at the wrong time, because at that time, you know, Mike Ingham was coming to the end of his time, and it was pretty clear that I would succeed Mike, and I really, really wanted to do that job for the reasons that I've already outlined, because of the standing of that role, and also what opportunities it gives you to do. Because I'm in a job now, and when it came to the decision about whether to stay or whether to go, I'm in a job now where, when I was growing up on that hill farm, if you'd said to me that I would go and get to commentate on all of the big football matches, all of them, you know, so this is not just certain competitions, you know, all of the biggest games, England at the World Cup, you know, getting an opportunity to cover them in a World Cup semi-final and everything that surrounded that this summer, as well as the other things that BBC Radio offer me the chance to do, whether it be the Ryder Cup, the Open Championship, the Masters, Olympics, Commonwealth Games, all that. So therefore...
You're making me very jealous.
Well, you know, I'm not saying it for those reasons. I'm saying it just to sort of explain how it was. The decision I had to make was whether to give up all of that and the enormous job satisfaction that that gives me and go and do just football and the great job that was potentially there at BT. And in the end, I had to decide what that job satisfaction was worth to me. And in the end, it was quite a straightforward decision at the time. And, you know, I've now done the job for 4 years after Mike stepped away. And, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed that and the challenges that it brings. So, difficult decision, but in the end, it was actually quite a straightforward decision.
Makes me wonder, what do you give the man who has everything? What aspirations do you have now in your career? Where do you see yourself in 10 years' time?
What I say, Alex, is that, and you probably understand this, and anyone who does commentate, I think, will probably understand it, in that it is a constant challenge. To do this well is a constant challenge. And, you know, even last week, you know, I walk away from a match where I think, I didn't do what I would consider to be a very good job. And that happens quite often. And Ron Jones, who I used to work with, Ron, who's just stopped commentating himself, I don't know
great
if you
voice.
Know. Yeah, great voice. Ron always used to say to me, among lots of very good pieces of advice that he gave me, was that commentating is actually very like playing. And he said, during the course of a season, you'll probably have 10 or 12 games where you think, wow, I really nailed it today. Really, really, you know, everything came together. That was it. He said, you'll probably have 10 or 12 games where you think, no, not good enough, poor. You know, not good enough. And then the rest are in the middle somewhere. And that's how it was, you know, if you remember, or I remember when I was playing football, it was very like that when you'd played during the course of a season. So I find it an ongoing and enduring challenge to do this job. And when you look at it and you think for a football match, you have 90 unscripted minutes of broadcasting, then, you know, it's understandable that you don't get everything right and why... it is an exciting challenge that it is.
You mentioned not getting everything right. When I was preparing for this chat, I did read an interview with you where you talked about a game that you did involving England and Croatia.
Yeah.
And the Paul Robinson, Gary Neville back pass. Just talk us through what happened there and how it didn't go right on the night.
Yeah, that was, we were in Zagreb in the Maximir Stadium. People will remember the game. Steve McLaren's England were well beaten really by Croatia that night. Really difficult night for them. And I remember midway through, I think it was the first half, the ball goes back to Gary Neville in the right back position. We are halfway through the first half, and it was one of those games where there were two of us. Mike Ingham was with me there doing the commentary on that match. Halfway through the first half, I'm at the point of handing over to him. And as I do that, you know, so I turn to him. So I turn to look at him because I know the ball's with Gary Neville in the right back position. So I'm saying something along the lines of, so halfway through the first half, look at Mike. And as I do that, there's a huge cheer that goes up. I look back. The ball's in the net. The ball is in the England net. Croatians are running away and celebrating. So, you know, panic stations. What do you say? And you just speak, as you do. And I just said exactly that. You know, I fell back on what I saw. I said, the ball's in the England net. Croatia have scored. Croatians are running away, celebrating. Simeonovic, I think it was, is leading the celebrations. And I said, crucially, Robinson's missed it, and Croatia have scored.
So you gambled?
So, well, I didn't gamble. I just said what had to be, that had to have happened. Robinson must have missed it because the ball's in the net. Yeah. What I didn't know was, and you know, I didn't actually see until after the match was what happened, because we didn't have TV replays either. We didn't have TV screens in the commentary position in the crumbling Maximir Stadium. So it was only afterwards that I actually found out what had happened. But great example of, if you take your eye off the action, what you can miss when you don't expect it. And you know that, even though I say that, even though that's a cautionary tale, that could happen again today.
I love John Murray's voice so much, but I also love what he said about the thread of the BBC football correspondent continuing and all learning from each other. And it made me just sort of stop and think, well, where else do you get that? What are the roles and what are the jobs does that happen in? And I thought it was really lovely how much he loves the history of the BBC and clearly how much he loves working for them. It just sort of, I guess it's quite inspiring, really. It was lovely.
Yeah, I must admit.
Made me feel quite jealous, all the various sporting events that he's covered over the years. Incredible CV, really.
I must admit, I do occasionally walk around the house trying to impersonate John Murray's voice. It's a very sad thing, I know, but I love his voice so much that I walk around talking. Whenever I talk about him to my wife, I always say, she says, you're going to meet up with John? I went, yeah, you know, Big John from Five Live. And she goes, yeah, I know, you don't have to do it in the voice every time.
John will be joining us again later to answer our quickfire questions. But next, we are going to discuss the pros and cons of a potential European Super League.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
So the Champions League returns this week. Sam will be covering Liverpool's trip to Red Star Belgrade for Talk Sports. But will the Reds soon be competing in a breakaway European Super League?
Well, according to leaked documents released by the German magazine Der Spiegel, Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal and both Manchester clubs are among 11 so-called founder members who are plotting, allegedly, to form a 16-team Super League in 2021, along with five invited guests.
That's right. The report says those 11 clubs, which will also include Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Juventus, AC Milan and Paris Saint-Germain, would be exempt from relegation, and the prize money for the winners would be a staggering £500 million.
Ooh.
But it's not anticipated that the Super League would affect the English team's participation in the Premier League, but it could mean they do not play in the FA Cup, the League Cup, and actually it puts the future of the Champions League in real doubt.
We should stress here that nobody's commented officially on the league, but in most quarters this has been labelled a really bad move for the English game. Crook, you've got a slightly different take on this after speaking to Mark Hughes on Friday about the widening quality gap between the Premier League elite and the rest of the division. Here's what Hughes said to you.
I think it's more and more difficult. I think probably since Leicester won the league, when a number of the top six maybe took their eye off the ball and were just in a little bit of transition. I think from that moment, basically, they've got their act together and they invested hugely, almost every one of the top six did. So it's very difficult to get as close as maybe teams have been able to do in the past, notwithstanding the fact they can only put 11 on the pitch and so can we. And we've invested and we've got good players. So it will always be 11 v 11 or... But clearly they can mix things up. They can cope with suspension, injuries, circumstances that develop in a season. And if they lose outstanding players, then they've got outstanding players to come back in. They're spending 30, 40 million on reserve fullbacks, which no one else can do.
Interesting views there. But where does it fit into the argument in favour of the Super League idea?
Well, listen, I should underline the case for my defence and say I'm not wholly in favour of this idea before I get accused of wrecking the traditions of English football. And I think it's really important that whatever changes are made to the way that European football is structured, that we keep true to the traditions of our game. You know, if these clubs are not going to play in the FA Cup and the League Cup, then straight away I would say it's a rank bad idea. If they can find a way to play in the Premier League, the two domestic cup competitions and this European Super League, I'm not totally against it. And here's why. Why is it that the Premier League has become the envy of the rest of the world? Why do the big players, the biggest players, come and ply their trade in England? Why did foreign television networks pay billions of pounds so they can show live Premier League games every weekend of the season? It's because that on any given Saturday, one of the big guns can be left with a bloody nose by the smaller teams in the league. Well, that's certainly been the case in previous years. It isn't the case anymore. The stats tell us that. There have been 48 matches this season involving the so-called big six teams in the league, the two Manchester clubs, Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal and Tottenham, and the other 14 teams in the league. How many points do you think the big six have dropped in those games? 144 points available over the course of those 48 matches.
Two. Manchester United against Wolves.
It's actually bigger than that. 17 out of 144.
Really?
However, it's a little bit skewed because Manchester United have actually dropped eight of them. They also lost at Brighton, you may remember.
Of course.
So it means that the other five teams have only dropped 9 points in 48 matches against those smaller sides. It happened last season when there was such a massive gap between the top six teams. They literally divvied the points up among themselves and the rest of the league were just feeding on scraps. I think that's a worrying trend. Not only that, but the margin of victories. Chelsea going away to Burnley and winning 4-0 without their best player wouldn't have happened 3 years ago. Manchester City smashed Southampton 6-1. We've said already, they've done that 12 times since Pep Guardiola came in. Mm. The gap between the big clubs and the rest of the league is getting smaller. It's diluting the quality. It's making it boring.
I'm not sure, though, that this sort of European Super League idea is going to fix that. Surely that's going to add to the problem because they'll want to be more competitive with these other so-called big teams they're in with. Surely it's going to create more of a gap when they come back to the Premier League.
I disagree. A, it will give them more of a challenge. And B, because they're trying to balance an extra competition, it may actually reduce that quality gap between the top six and the other teams. But what they're also concerned about, listen, this is about money. £500 million is the main carrot. Because I think they're worried that the television money that comes in when the rights are next negotiated won't be as much as they are now because people are switching off.
Yeah. I don't know if they're switching off, but I just don't think that companies are going to be prepared to play as much as they were beforehand. I just don't think that's going to happen. It is all about money. I'd instinctively be against this for multiple reasons. Relegation and promotion are the most important things that happen in our game, integral parts of it since its inception. The game grew out of communities, and the long game here will discount that because the idea will be that Real Madrid play Liverpool in Beijing eventually, or Manchester United play Barcelona in the Giant Stadium in New York. That is going to be the ultimate plan. I don't like that this will be a football competition that effectively could lay waste to Liverpool versus Everton as a meaningful fixture, Tottenham versus Arsenal, Paris against Marseille, Lazio versus Roma, probably one of the big Turkish derbies as well. But it is clear that something is brewing and has been for a while now, and money talks. And if it was me running European football right now, I'd be taking this as a massive hint that I need to do whatever I can to make sure that it comes within the auspices of the current governing bodies, rather than being farmed out to a group that are going to take control away from UEFA, FIFA, or the Premier League, or the nations associations, because then there'll be no responsibility for that group to give money back to the grassroots of the game and to build the pyramid. It's all about the pyramid. You know, they want to Americanize it. They want to take their cues from the NFL, but football is a very different game. And the pyramid system is key. You've got to maintain that. I think some change is inevitable, but not a cartel of the best with no possible progression into that club.
Yeah. Okay. I should say, it just feels like it would be complete elitism. You're going to have these clubs that are untouchable because there's no promotion or relegation. What is actually the point of it? And what's the incentive for other clubs to even try and get involved with it if they can't? I can't see the longevity of it. Just wouldn't see how it would work, to be honest.
And the other thing, Alex, you turned around and said it might weaken them because they're playing the Premier League, they're playing this European Super League, blah, blah, blah. But they're not going to. They already play too many games. They're not going to play an 18-team European Super League, a 20-team Premier League, and then one of the cup competitions. It just isn't going to happen. But ultimately, I think what you have to understand is that one day this kind of stuff is going to happen. Someone's going to play someone big in a different country. And you don't like it, I don't like it. It's not that I don't like it. I don't think that's where the game comes from. But ultimately, it is going to happen. So you've got two choices. You can either bury your head in the sand and think, no, this is not going to happen. I'm just going to protest against it. Or you can try and be a part of shaping it to your advantage.
And just back to the point about the quality level in the Premier League, that's only going to get wider, in my opinion. So Do the governing body, do the Premier League and the FA need to look at it and work out a way to bridge that quality gap? I mean, could we have an NFL draft type system where the team who finished bottom of the table get the first pick in the summer transfer market? Could that ever work, Sam, in English football?
No. No chance. Because it's the money. Predicated
it's never
on
work.
Money.
Yeah.
It's never
a worry
happen.
For me. It's a worry for me. I just think we're in danger outside those big six games of losing the competitive edge that has set this league apart. And actually, we talked about it already. If Manchester City are going to keep winning the league by 10 or 12 points, we're going to become the Bundesliga. And how dull is that?
Yeah, or like you look at things like La Liga and you just look at some of those games and you just know that Barcelona are going to beat some minions that are we consider the minions at the bottom of the Spanish league. And I agree with Crook that we don't want it to go that way. However, this European Super League is not the answer to try and fix that.
I think it's worth pointing out, though, you know, that the Bundesliga isn't dominated by Bayern Munich this year. They're third.
Yet.
Mönchengladbach are second. Dortmund are top by 4 points. And Leipzig are very close behind them. So, I mean, the top four there are really, really bunched. And they would argue that their game actually has become more competitive over the last year or so, maybe even a couple of years. Bayern Munich have had a spell where they've dominated, but, you know, Dortmund have been involved not in the too distant past. So I think these things are cyclical. Manchester United at one stage were untouchable in the Premier League and they'd have one challenger each year. And that challenger would come and go and it would be someone different. So first it was Blackburn, then it was Arsenal, then it was Chelsea, and then latterly Manchester City, and then Manchester United have fallen away a little bit. So these things are cyclical, but at the same time, I think it's important to retain that localness.
Well, it's definitely a proposal that will generate plenty of opinion, as it has here. And remember, you can share your views on that or anything else related to the podcast by tweeting us or Instagramming us on @AFCGeeks. And next, the lovely John Murray will be back to answer our quick fire questions.
Okay, John Murray is back with us. John, you're going to take our quick fire quiz. Basically, you've got 60 seconds to rattle off as much about your career as possible. First of all, what's the one thing that you take with you to every match?
I take my binoculars.
Which summariser keeps you on your toes the most?
Probably Robbie Savage.
Which game that you've commentated sticks most in the mind?
I think... that's a tricky one. I'll go for Manchester City Monaco from the Champions League a couple of years ago.
And on the same tone, if you could go back in time and commentate any sporting event, not necessarily football, what would it be?
Right, I'd go for Keogh Island, the Ryder Cup, which was the last Ryder Cup I didn't go to. But that, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
What's the worst journey you've had on your commentary travels, or the worst overnight stay?
Motorway closures in the middle of the night are the bane of the football commentator's night. And I remember a couple of years ago ending up because of motorway closures in Accrington in the middle of the night and thinking, what? Almost banging my head on the driving wheel, thinking, what am I doing here?
And in terms of a hotel, you obviously cover many England games abroad. Is there one particularly bad hotel experience?
Yes. I remember staying in an airport hotel in Brussels when a couple of flights had been cancelled. Got in there, middle of the night, and the room hadn't been cleaned. It smelled of smoke. The bed sheets were dirty. And I thought, I've just got to go to sleep.
Well, we've all had that hotel experience somewhere on our travels. When I was starting with Portsmouth, there was three of us that used to travel to every game, and the radio station that I worked for made us all stay in the same room. And I remember once we did a Sheffield Wednesday game, and me, Alan McLaughlin, who used to play for the Republic of Ireland and Portsmouth amongst others, our reporter all stayed in one room. So me and Alan shared a double bed. It was in an Ibis hotel. It was so tiny you wouldn't believe, you could hardly breathe in there. Me, Alan in the double bed, and the reporter on a camp bed which had been made up by the side of the double bed, and you literally had no room to move around. And at one stage, Alan come out the shower and he's just walking around naked. And I was like, what are you doing this for? What are you doing this for? And he's like, oh, get over yourself. Because he's a footballer and he's just used to walking around naked amongst everybody else.
Oh, I've got a naked story as well. I was
of course you have.
Chelsea in Valencia with Kerry Dixon for Smooth Radio back in the day when they used to cover football. And we'd arranged to go out for dinner that evening, so I was staying in the next room to Kerry, not the same room, but I knocked his door, and he opened it, full length, completely starkers, and invited me in for a cup of tea. So I'm fully clothed, I'm sat on Kerry Dixon's bed, having a cup of tea, and he's in the buff next to me.
Did he give you a biscuit?
I wasn't dunking anything in that tea, I can tell you.
I can't really compete with these naked stories. Okay, that's it for another week. Thanks for your company. Please remember to tell all your friends about the podcast and be sure to join us again next week when we will be back with another big name guest.
Who hopefully won't be naked.
Let's hope not.
Tweet the Geeks @AFCGeeks or get in touch on Instagram.